It was 2002 when reporters with the Boston Globe first revealed how the Catholic Church had spent decades giving cover and protection to priests who were raping children. These revelations created a double penalty for the victims of these priests, along with the emotional hurt that they carried, as well as the families who lost loved ones who were victims who committed suicide. The victims had to face a reality that, thanks to the statute of limitations, no legal action could be taken. At least that's what the Catholic Church was banking on, literally and figuratively. 18 years later, the tide has thankfully turned in favor of the victims. Our first guest is with us today to explain the mechanics of the legal recourse that now exists for the victims of the people who were abused by priests and denied by the Catholic Church. He's a partner with the law firm Levy Koningsberg, LLP. Corey Stern, thanks for being here today, Corey.
Thank you so much for having me.
Website for, especially for you as a victim, that is indeed you, or a family member who is a survivor, one who tragically took their lives because of the pain that was inflicted upon them. A website for you to reference is sexabuseclaimscenter.com. We've added that to our link page as well over at our website. Just as an overview, because in New Jersey, New York, California, many of the states, the tide has indeed turned in favor of the victims. How wide have the gates opened now?
Well, they've opened significantly wider than they've ever been, and many states are going to follow. In New York, it used to be where you couldn't file a lawsuit past the age of 23 if you were sexually abused as a child. That's changed now to the extent where, A, if someone was sexually abused as a child today, they'd have until the age of 55. And for anybody that was sexually abused and missed that 23-year-old period, they have a whole year from August of 2019 through August of 2020. In New Jersey, it's a 2-year window that's opened for survivors whose statute had passed. California's got a 3-year window. So it's percent wider because previously it was completely closed. So legislatures, as a result of, you know, the Me Too movement and sort of progressive legislatures being elected in various states, have just taken this as a priority and run with it.
And when it comes to the legal options that are available now to victims, is it, how many different charges can they now levy at the church? Is it just limited to sexual assault, sexual abuse, or are there other charges and other recourses that the victims could take now under these new laws?
Essentially, anything that arises out of the sexual abuse. And so, you know, there's a lot of legal mumbo jumbo. You know, we use Latin terms and legal terms. But, you know, if someone was sexually abused, the claim doesn't have to just be I was sexually abused. You can allege negligence. And so, for instance, say you have a physician at a hospital who was prolifically molesting children over a period of decades. It's not just the abuse that occurred as a result of the doctor's actions. You can also file suit against the hospital that either employed him and knew about it, or employed him and should have known about it, employed him and trained him or failed to train him, knew that it had happened and retained him. And so it extends well beyond just the abuse itself, but there has to be a nexus. There has to be a link or a connection to the abuse.
So there is a burden of proof. Someone just can't come forward and claim abuse. They have to have some sort of connection, either through what's been revealed by the church and the diocese themselves or corroborating evidence. It just can't be a claim and then the ball starts rolling.
Well, I mean, in essence, to prove a claim, you'd want to have as much evidence as possible. But frankly, it is enough if a 55-year-old man alleges that he was sexually abused at 8 years old by Father O'Connor at the Archdiocese of Brooklyn, for instance. His word may be good enough if a jury ultimately believes the veracity of his story. So, you know, that would typically be very little evidence, and it may not be as compelling as if there were reports of Father O'Connor abusing other children that were credible, or if the church itself or that diocese had done its own investigation of that particular individual. But it really is enough to say, I was abused, because if your story is believed by a jury, then that's evidence. You know, testimony is evidence.
And I've spoken with some victims over the years, too. I've been talking about this since the Boston Globe reporters actually had them on the show back in 2002. And it's great to see this point in time come about for the victims. They've said, in New Jersey, for example, the collective diocese have released 185 names. There are many other names still to be revealed. And the more victims that come forward, the more perpetrators will become revealed, and the more justice that can result of all this.
That's right, and it's like an avalanche, and it's also extremely cathartic and therapeutic. It's what was a taboo subject for a victim to talk about, especially a generation of victims who, you know, grew up in the 40s, 50s, 60s, you know, World War II, post-World War II, rub some dirt on it, get over it, let's move on. This wasn't something that a nine-year-old kid in 1950 would have necessarily gone home and talked to his mother or father about. But today, some of these older gentlemen who are now in their 60s, 70s, some in their 80s, who have never told anybody about what happened to them, but when they backtrack through the moments of their lives and they look at their issues with intimacy or their issues with relationships with their children or a desire or a lack of desire to ever have kids out of fear of what that relationship might be like, the avalanche of people who are coming forward is creating a cathartic foundation for other people to be able to talk about this beyond the money that's potentially available to victims, beyond this that's associated with our legal system. There's just a burden that's being lifted off of so many people emotionally and in some instances physically to just be able to talk about this and know that they're not alone.
Dr. Corey Stern, who is a partner with the law firm Levy Koningsberg LLP, talking about the legal options available to victims of abuse by priests. The website for you to find out more information, by the way, is sexabuseclaimscenter.com. And you're listening to Issues and Ideas. I also want to give credit, too, in this conversation to New Jersey State Senator Joseph Vitale, who spent over a decade trying to overcome being blocked of getting these new laws that exist in New Jersey even on the legislative calendar because of the pressure put on by the Catholic Church and their various advocates. So thanks to Senator Vitale and their other senators and politicians in other states who did not want to be silenced by the church and knew what the wrongs were, then fought through to make these pieces of legislation become the eventual laws. I noticed that the Catholic Church, many dioceses, Rochester most recently, I believe, are filing for bankruptcy. How much of that action is that going to complicate things?
It's not necessarily a complication as much as it is a potential diminishment of what individuals might be able to recover. The Catholic Church is a, you know, some people think about the, you know, Catholicism and various dioceses as, you know, kind of 17th, 18th, and that's sort of how they fund themselves. The Catholic Church is a sophisticated business, and they run very corporately. And so if it goes bankruptcy, you have to list your liabilities, and ultimately a bankruptcy trustee or a bankruptcy court will determine if there's value to particular claims. It makes the process different. You know, if I file a lawsuit on behalf of a victim of sexual abuse against the Archdiocese of Brooklyn, and they are not in bankruptcy, we're litigating the case in the same way we would against flags for somebody dying on a roller coaster, or, you know, against Home Depot if somebody were to accidentally have a limb cut off by a saw or something. When you're in a bankruptcy proceeding, it's not the same type of litigation. You are submitting claims to bankruptcy who will evaluate the veracity of the claim in conjunction with evaluating the liquidity and financial wherewithal of the entity in bankruptcy to actually pay those claims. So not every entity is doing it because bankruptcy comes with its own share of difficulties post-bankruptcy for the entity, be it the Catholic Church or some other corporate entity.
Given what bankruptcy law is, what it is in a very state to state, obviously, but let's take that idea and extend it. If this was the idea of a defense by the diocese collectively, can the Vatican be joined into a lawsuit then in that case?
There have been attempts, and bankruptcy law is governed by federal law. So you know, every bankruptcy proceeding is actually relatively uniform across the country. The Vatican, there's issues with bringing the Vatican into a case because of it's not a domestic entity. It's obviously an international entity. And the way that folks have tried to do it in the past, and no one really has tried to do it since these laws have begun to become effective and enacted, but you have to sort of allege that there's a conspiracy of some kind. You know, RICO is a fancy word for international or cross state lines conspiracy. And the argument to be made, and I think it's a valid one, although not anyone that I know of yet has successfully made it to any particular court, is for years and years and years, if not decades upon decades, the Vatican was aware of a cultural issue within its ranks that involved hundreds, if not thousands, of members of their church sexually abusing young boys in particular. And they would move a father from one diocese to another. They would continue to put these individuals who were perpetrating the abuse in different settings, in different places, but performing the same duties around the same types of people, children. And so the argument could easily be made that rather than, you know, whatever the Catholic version of firing someone is, you know, rather than doing that or bringing them to a place where they wouldn't be around kids, they just sort of played kind of a game of whack-a-mole, and they would place these fathers in other situations. And the most egregious forms of abuse that I've seen are when there were credible reports of abuse by an individual within the church who was then moved to another church or another area of the same state or to a different state, and then they perpetrated abuse on other children.
Yeah, or they were, quote-unquote, retired, but still placed into roles where they still had contact with youth and perpetrated their evil again. For New Jersey, victims who were previously barred from suing because of the statute of limitations, you now have, as of December 1st of 2019, a two-year window to pursue your case, and allows adults who were assaulted as children to file civil suits until they turn 55 or 7 years after they discover that they were abused. And that really means psychologically you finally realize, okay, I've been holding this in, and I've been, through help, made to realize what happened. To find out what your legal options are, then contact Levy Koningsberg, LLP, 1-800-225-9825, 1-800-225-9825. You can also find out more on their website, sexabuseclaimscenter.com. We have that link over at our page as well for your reference. We've been joined by a partner with law firm Levy Koningsberg, LLP, Corey Stern. Corey, thanks so much for helping the victims understand what recourse they now have, the mechanics of all of it. Thanks for being here today.
And thanks for, you know, on your platform, talking about issues like this that are so important. You have so many people that listen to you, and it's really, no pun intended, but kind of God's work what you're doing out there. So I really appreciate you.